a glowing dot at the map center. That's our shuttle. It seemed so small, further emphasizing the vastness of the ruined city. Gaston gestures to the map's circular edge. That's as far as the shuttle can see. Even though it's fairly small on the map, the tallest ziggurat, the one on top of the two intersecting roads, is detailed enough for me to make out a pillar at the very top, where the yellow vines don't grow. Six black symbols run down its length. Empty circle, circle star, double ring, circle cross, half circle, and at the bottom, the tooth circle, or gear. About two-thirds of the way up that ziggurat, on a corner, a vine-covered statue of a person faces up toward the peak. I can't tell if it is a man or a woman. The statue must be huge. This building seems important. Gaston, I say, how long would it take us to reach that tall ziggurat? He leans toward it, thinks. If you walk fast, the better part of a day, most likely. O'Malley reaches out to touch the buildings near his waist, as if they are tiny things he might pick up. His hand goes right through them, kicking up a small cloud of sparkles. These buildings look different from the rest, he says. I see what he means. The ones near him are more broken down, partially collapsed, many with caved-in roofs and trees growing out of them. Their shapes are different, six sides, not four like most of the buildings on the map, and they are smaller, dwarfed by even the medium-sized ziggurats. To the northeast, a bit past the waterfall, I notice a thick line that intersects the map's circle. The six-sided buildings are all on the far side of that line. I point at it. Is that a wall? Gaston reaches down with both hands, grabs the air above that section, and stretches his hands apart. The map zooms in. There is less detail now, and the image looks a bit fuzzy, but it is clearly a high, thick wall. Aramovsky crosses his arms, frowns in thought. Four-sided buildings on our side of the wall, six-sided on the other, he says. Why would that be? No one answers. O'Malley takes in a sharp breath of surprise, points. Zoom in on that. Gaston does. It's a rectangular building, big enough to hold a dozen shuttles, about halfway between us and the waterfall. The building is covered in yellow vines, like all the others, but it has a unique feature. Thick vine-draped poles rising up from the roof's edge, as if there is an army of spear holders down there, standing guard, weapons held high. The poles taper to a rounded tip with just the hint of a point. I almost recognize that shape. Those are statues of corn, O'Malley says. The building is a warehouse. We all look at him, doubtful. O'Malley's steady calm has vanished. His eyes are bright and his smile blazes. A smile so real and beautiful, it makes my breathing stop. I remember something, he says. My progenitor's father, worked for a city. Maybe. Anyway, my progenitor saw buildings like this. They're used to store food. If he's right, that means the grown-ups built this city. So where are they? What happened to them? If that building holds food, it could mean the difference between life and death. We need to learn what plants we can and can't eat, how to farm and hunt, but mastering those skills will probably take much longer than our supplies will last. It's not far, Gaston says. It would only take a couple of hours to walk there. Aramovsky points to the glowing dot at the map center. Why not just fly the shuttle right to it? I'm not sure there's a place to land, Gaston says. And besides, the shuttle needs fuel to fly. He pauses, opens his mouth to say something, then closes it. Spingate finishes for him. We have barely enough fuel left for one trip to the Zolotl. If we fly around for other purposes, for anything, we won't be able to go back. Not ever. Everyone falls silent. I hadn't realized going back was an option. The thought is uncomfortable. If we fail on Omeokan, our survival might depend on returning to a place where people want to kill us. Aramovsky waves a hand dismissively. The God of Blood sent us here. We are destined to succeed. God gave us this shuttle, and we should use it to—
We walk, I say sharply, cutting him off.
Like Bishop said, we have to reconnoiter anyway, so we'll do some of that while we go to the warehouse. If we find food there, we have more time to figure out what to do next.
Bishop stands straighter.
I'll take Farrar and Kyoto. We'll move fast, come back, and report to you.
I'll go as well, Spingate says.
Bishop shakes his head.
No, you'll slow us down.
Spingate lifts the arm with the bracer.
If we find food or water, this will tell us if it's poisonous.
If we find food or water, we'll bring some back, Bishop says. Then you can tell us if it's safe.
Spingate puts her hands on her hips.
She's going, I say.
As am I.
Bishop glares at me. So does O'Malley.
It's dangerous, Em, O'Malley says. The leader shouldn't go out until we know you won't get hurt.
Once again, the boys want to keep me safe. Too bad. I'm not the kind to hide away when there is work to be done.
If I don't face danger, I can't ask others to do the same, I say. And we don't know what plants or animals we'll find on the way. We have no idea what might be edible here. Spingate will evaluate as we go.
Bishop sighs, shakes his head. O'Malley forces the scowl off his face.
Let's get ready, I say. O'Malley, you and Gaston are in charge while I'm gone. We need to know everything that's in this shuttle, and find out who's inside those coffins.
5. We set out from the shuttle. Spingate and I, along with Bishop, Coyote, and Farrar. Everyone sees us off, waving and cheering. O'Malley is staying behind. He can't hide his concern. Is he worried about my safety? That he'll have to keep an eye on Aramovsky? Or is he worried I'll be with Bishop? Maybe it's all those things. At least O'Malley wasn't as bad as Gaston. The little pilot looked like he was on the edge of tears because Spingate was leaving. Just before we left, I saw them facing each other, holding hands. He looked at the ground, nodding his head while she spoke softly.
I have the spear. Bishop has his red axe. The heavy shovel rests on Farrar's shoulder.
Coyote still prefers his tried-and-true thigh bone.
Spingate carries the jewel-studded tool I found back in Zolotl's coffin room. Her bag also holds a white case filled with bandages, sharp little knives, pills, needles, and the thread for stitching wounds, containers of ointments and other things. Smith taught Spingate how to use all of it.
Opkik and Borjigin, teenage half-circles who were originally with Bishop's crew, took it upon themselves to start an inventory of the storerooms. They sent each of us off with a small black bag containing some food, a bottle of water, and a flashlight. They also found a handful of knives, with sheaths that strap around our thighs.
There aren't many of these, so we only give them to the Circle Stars.
We climb the ring of piled vines and descend the other side. Just like that, the shuttle is gone from sight. We're heading into the unknown. Am I frightened? Of course. But I have also grown accustomed to this. The unknown is all that I have ever known. We walk down a wide, vine-covered street. The sounds of our people quickly fade away. Leaves rattle, the dead city hissing at us. A light breeze brings new smells. I now recognize the minty scent of the vines. Most odors, though, neither I nor Matilda have ever known before. Buildings rise up on either side of the street. Some are boxy, but most are stepped pyramids, ziggurats. Those remind me of something from my childhood. Matilda's childhood, I mean. I remember a wedding. I remember staring up at the cake, at 4 layers, each layer smaller than the one below it. At the top, a little statue of 2 people. I thought it was a toy. I wanted to play with it, but Mother wouldn't let me. Some of the pyramids are small, 3 or 4 layers, while others are massive, 20 layers or more. The biggest of these have layers so wide that there are smaller ziggurats built upon the flat spaces. Vines cover almost everything, softening shapes, turning the orange-brown stone a pale fuzzy yellow. As I walk, I realize I don't feel as anxious about the sprawling sky above. All this open space, it feels like I belong here. I'm beginning to understand that this is natural. This is the way things should be. Being cramped in a shuttle or packed into narrow hallways is not. A few buildings have collapsed. Young trees rise up from the street, from rooftops, from the sloped sides of the ziggurats. Trunks of green and brown, leaves a darker yellow than those of the vines. The way tree roots clutch at stone walls makes me think more buildings will collapse as the years roll on. Birds fly overhead. Well, not the birds I know from Matilda's memories, but brightly colored animals about the same size. Instead of feathered, flapping wings, these things have two sets of stiff, buzzing membranes. The membranes move so fast they are a blur. Blurds. That's what I will call these creatures. Some are small, some big. A large one sweeps its wings back against its long body and dives, then pulls up sharply, extending claws that snatch a smaller blurred right out of the air with a sickening smack crunch. Death lives here. Death lived on the Zolotl. Perhaps death lives everywhere. Farrar turns in circles as he walks forward, almost tripping, gawking up at the towering pyramids. Where is everyone? There should be people. Lots of them. Yet the only motion comes from blurreds and blowing leaves. If O'Malley is right about the warehouse, the grown-ups built all of this. So where do they go? By the time we reach the warehouse, the red sun is directly overhead. Heat beats down on us, makes my shirt damp. I hope we can go inside and find some shade. The warehouse is built from the same vine-covered stone that makes up the rest of the city. It's tall and wide, with a peaked roof that faces our street. The vines are so thick, they almost obscure two huge stone doors that look like they're designed to slide apart. If those doors opened all the way, the shuttle could roll in with plenty of room to spare on either side. Cornstalk statues rise up from the roof's edges. This close to them, the vines look like old spider webs strung between the posts. Bishop points to the base of the big doors. Let's try there. We walk closer. Through the thick plant cover, I see a person-sized door set into the big sliding one. How did he spot that? Bishop rips vines, tosses them aside. He exposes a pair of familiar-looking holes in the small door's frame. Spingate looks at me for permission. I nod. She inserts the golden tool and starts pressing jewels, trying to unlock it. Several minutes pass. The heat pounds down. I'm getting bored, and so are the others. Spin, is that going to work or not? Almost got it, she says. The door clicks, grinds inward. Dirt falls. Dust puffs. A stale smell billows out, carried on a wave of cold air. Axe in one hand, flashlight in the other. Bishop enters, Coyotl and Farrar at his heels. I stand alone with Spingate. She seems distracted, as if all of this wonder is lost on her. Spin, are you all right? She looks at me, forces a smile. Yes. I'm worried about Gaston. Something could happen to him while we're gone. Not something could happen to the others, but rather something could happen to him. I remember the way the two of them wrestled back on the Zolotl, laughing and playing. Different from how the others played. I feel awkward and uncomfortable talking about this. I've never kissed a boy, or a girl, for that matter, so I don't know what I'm talking about. But it seems to me she really likes Gaston. Are you and he, more than just friends? She sniffs. I think I love him. Love? I wasn't expecting that. Love is for older people. But then, we are older, aren't we? Could I fall in love? I feel a surge of happiness. We're starting a new world down here. We need love. We need people to make babies. A rush of shame. Flashes of people in black uniforms hitting me, calling me evil and blasphemous. My skin suddenly feels hot, and it's not from the sun. What did Matilda have to go through as a child? For the first time, I feel actual sympathy for her, and I hate myself for it. Em, are you okay? Yes, sorry. I wave at myself, trying to cool off my skin. Gaston, does he love you back? Her eyes wrinkle in a smile that owns every bit of her face. Well, when we were in the pilot house, we... Bishop's head pops out of the door.
Em, you have to see this.
No vines in here. Flashlight beams play off tall blue racks that stretch away from us, rise up to the slanted roof far above. White bins pack the racks, bins large enough for me to fit inside if I scrunch tight enough. The floor feels smooth, but is covered in dirt and bumpy spots. A few blurs zip through the darkness, their presence known only by the buzzing of wings and high-pitched chirps. I try not to think that the bumps under my bare feet are probably blurred poop. So dim in here. So many places to hide. I think back to the Zolotl's long hallways, the shadowy places where the pigs lurked. I think back to Latu's body, surrounded by bloody hoof prints. I hate dark places. Bishop creeps to the closest rack, axe at the ready. Nothing happens. He rests his axe against the rack, slowly pulls out a bin. Flashlight beams catch shimmers of movement, shiny little things scurrying off the bin, scampering away into the darkness. Some kind of insect, maybe. Bishop places the bin on the dirty floor. On top of the bin is a profile of a jaguar, yellow and black. The jaguar's eye is a clear jewel. Bishop stares at the bin for a moment, hands searching the sides, brushing away dust and dead bugs. He presses the jaguar's eye. A click, then the top of the bin opens. Two halves sliding to the sides just like the lids of our birth coffins back on the Zolotl. We join him. Inside the bin are dark pink packages, each marked with simple letters. The letters look worn, fuzzy, but we can make out the words. Protein, bread, vegetables, vitamins. That answers that, Spingate says. The packages are a different color, but other than that, they look exactly like what we found in the shuttle. The grown-ups built this place. Bishop reaches in with his left hand, pulls out a package labeled biscuits. He switches the package to his right hand, then looks at his left, red dust on his fingers. The package isn't actually dark pink. There are white spots where his fingers held it. Spingate frowns. Bishop, put it down. Let me see if it's still edible. Bishop sets the package on the floor. Spingate waves her bracelet over it. Farrar gives the bin a light kick, as if to make sure it's real. He looks up at the endless racks. So much, he says. We can eat forever and ever. Not forever, I know, but there is enough to last us years. This will give us plenty of time to learn farming and hunting. It's hard to control my excitement. I want to dance and shout. I want to celebrate. Coyote walks down the long center aisle, craning his head, looking left and right, trying to take it all in. The gods provided for us, he says. Irimovsky speaks the truth. The mention of that name almost spoils the moment. Of course Irimovsky will attribute this to the gods, when clearly it was people who built this city and made this food. Coyote pulls a bin from the rack, sets it on the floor and opens it. Hey, cookies! He tears open a pink package and pulls out a small black circle. The sight of it makes my mouth water. Matilda had treats like that when she was little. but we don't know if it's safe to eat.
Coyote, put it down, I say.
He looks at it wistfully, then sets the cookie and the package back in the bin.
Farrar drops his shovel and sprints to the bin. He pulls out the same cookie that Coyote held.
Farrar's smile is so bright, it could light up the entire warehouse.
Finally! Sweets!
Before I can tell him to drop it, he pops the whole thing into his mouth and crunches down.
The gods provide, he says, chewing and grinning.
Coyote's frowning. He stares at his fingers like there is something wrong with them, flicks them like he's trying to shake off a bug. Movement on my left. Bishop, wiping his hand against what's left of his pants, a worried look on his face.
My fingers are tingling, he says. They sting a little.
I hear a sharp beep. The sound comes from Spingate's bracer. The jewels all flash a bright orange, an obvious color of warning. She stands quickly.
The red powder is mold. It's toxic!
The word stabs through my chest. I drop my spear, sprint to Farrar.
Spit it out! Spit it out!
Still chewing, he looks at me like he doesn't understand what I'm saying. Then I realize he's not looking at me at all. His eyes are glassy, unfocused.
These cookies taste awful, he says in a sleepy voice, then stumbles backward.
I try to catch him as he falls, but his weight drags us both down. I scramble to my knees, hearing feet slapping against the floor as the others run our way. Farrar gags, his eyes roll up, showing only whites that gleam ghostly in the flashlight beams.
Spingate slides down next to me, grabs Farrar's face, jams her fingertips and thumbs into his cheeks, forcing his jaw open.
Em, get it out of his mouth before he swallows!
I reach in with my fingers, scoop out half-chewed cookie, and throw the black mess aside. I slide fingertips between his lips and gums, under his tongue, fling more poison away. My skin is already tingling.
Coyote! Water!
Spingate barks. She turns Farrar's face to the side.
Wash out his mouth!
Coyote aims his container at Farrar's open mouth and squeezes. A jet of water splashes across Farrar's tongue, dribbles onto the dirty floor. Farrar starts to twitch. He convulses, body contracting violently. His forehead smashes into Spingate's cheek, sends her sprawling. Bishop locks his arms around Farrar's upper body, holds him tight. All our flashlights are on the floor, except for Coyote's, the beam of which dances madly across Farrar's face. Spingate is there again, blood coursing down her cheek. She's looking inside the white case Smith gave her, trying to find something specific. She removes a small white device barely bigger than her pinky, presses it to Farrar's throat. I hear a small snicked sound. She pulls the device away, drawing a thin metal needle with it. She injected him with something. Farrar's body lurches hard, then relaxes all at once. His eyes flutter open. I can see his irises. His chest heaves. Spingate holds his face again, but gently this time.
Farrar, it's Spingate. Can you see me?
His eyes widen, focus on her. He nods. I feel my held breath rush out. He's okay. Farrar looks at me, confused, then at Bishop.
What happened?
You ate the cookies, Bishop says. Everyone, make sure you do not eat the cookies.
Bishop is so solemn and serious. I start laughing. The sound is awkward. I shouldn't be laughing, because there's nothing funny about any of this. But I can't help it. Spingate examines her 20th bin. Bishop and Coyote have been bringing them back from all over the warehouse. Coyote even climbed up high to grab one, somehow managing to get all the way back down while holding it under one arm. We watch the bracer on Spingate's wrist as she waves her hand over the bin's contents, a dozen dark pink boxes that tease us with simple names for food. The jewels flash orange. I look over at Farrar. He's sheened with sweat. It's been maybe an hour since he ate the cookie, and he's still breathing hard. Spin thinks he'll be fine, but when we get back to the shuttle, I'll make sure Smith takes a look at him. Spingate closes the bin she just examined. The jaguar's jewel eye sparkles. She looks at Bishop.
You're sure this was from farther away?
He points down the warehouse's main aisle.
I got it from the end, next to the far wall, and I looked inside probably 100 bins along the way. They all have the red powder.
Spingate shakes her head.
The powder is a microorganism so small it can get into the containers, even get through the wrappers and right into the food. If we hadn't acted as fast as we did, Farrar would be dead.
She looks up at me. Once the mold contaminates food, there's nothing we can do to make it edible again. She looks down, as if it's her fault that we're in a building full of food, yet we can't eat any of it. At least we have the shuttle's supplies. We have time to figure out other answers. I remember Brewer's strange words back on the Zolotl. Hopefully you can break the mold. If you can't, that was one very long trip for nothing. Break the mold. He knew. One long trip for nothing.
The mold, I say to Spingate. How does it spread?
She stands up, brushes off her hands, and shrugs.
My guess is the microorganisms probably make little eggs.
No, that's not quite right.
They make spores, little bits so small they float on the air. They land on things and the process starts over.
If it spreads through the air, I grab her arm.
Could these spores get into the shuttle stores?
Spingate's eyes widen.
Yes, they could.
A few minutes ago, we thought we had enough food to last for years. All we have is what's on the shuttle. If that goes bad, we're doomed.
Spingate looks at her water container. She turns it upside down. Two drops come out. Then, nothing.
She emptied it, and Coyotl's as well, further cleaning out Farrar's mouth.
I emptied mine, washing my hands until they stopped stinging. Bishop did the same with his.
Just like that, we're almost out of water.
Spingate stares at the empty container.
If the water in the city carries the same spores, we can't drink it, she says.
We'll die of dehydration long before we get hungry. We have to find fresh water and test it.
She looks at me. I know what she's thinking. The river. I remember the pilot house map. That waterfall isn't far from here.
6. We stop and stare. The distant waterfall's soft roar echoes through the streets, but no one is paying attention to that. Coyotl breaks her silence.
Those are some big goddamn doors.
I glance at him annoyed. Does he need to curse? I can't remember much of school, but Matilda's memories give me the sense that cursing brought discipline. The paddle. Or something even worse. I vaguely remember a phrase. The rod.
He sees me staring, stares back. He raises an eyebrow, daring me to correct him.
In school, he'd be in trouble. But we're not in school anymore. And I have to admit, he's right. Those are some goddamned big doors.
We stand in the middle of a wide street facing east. The waterfall is somewhere off to our left, to the north. Buildings and ziggurats flank us, reaching up to the sky. Far ahead of us, the street ends at an archway set into a massive vine-choked wall. The wall is as tall as 20 of us standing on each other's shoulders. Towers spot its length, each of them rising up even higher than the wall itself. In that archway, metal doors half as high as the wall. They look like they swing outward. No vines on them, although a few dangle down from the arch above. Maybe plants can't grip metal like they can stone. I see a sliver of yellow between those doors. The door on our right looks slightly open. I remember Gaston's map. That yellow must be the vine-choked ruins that lie beyond. We'll have to explore that gate soon, but first we have something more important to worry about.
Let's go, I say. We need to find the waterfall.
We turn north. We follow a narrower street, moving toward the river's roar.
It looked a lot smaller on the map. The waterfall soars above us, white froth crashing down into a clear pool. The red sun is just above the waterfall's edge, only a few hours until nightfall. Spray hangs in the air, catching the afternoon light. Brightly colored blurs dart in and out of the hanging mist. A set of switchback steps, carved into the dark stone, leads up the waterfall's right side. 10 steps to the right, sharp turn, 10 to the left, and so on, all the way up. Vine-draped boulders, each as tall as my chest, line the pool's edge. A ring of smaller rocks runs along the outside of the boulders. A second ring, glistening wet from the water that splashes against them, runs along the inside. Vines cover the flat ground. Buildings and ziggurats rise up all around us. Perhaps this place was a plaza of some kind, open and welcome to this lost city's forgotten residents. Coyote hops onto a boulder. His covering of caked ash is almost gone. He's more filthy than fierce now, a dirty boy with reddish skin and taut, fluttering muscles. He looks into the pool, then raises his thigh bone high and whoops.
I'm going swimming!
No! I have to shout to be heard over the water's crash. We don't know if it's safe! Coyote rolls his eyes.
You think because you're in charge you can just boss people around. Aramovsky was right about you.
Shut up, Bishop says. Farrar almost died from eating something. That water could be just as poisonous. Coyote glances at the water. That common sense thought hadn't occurred to him. He sighs, sits down on the big rock. I'm grateful that Bishop supports me, but my thoughts stick on what Coyote just said. Aramovsky has been talking about me behind my back. I'm the one that got us off the Zolotl. I'm the one who got us to Omeokan. It hurts that Coyote would think badly of me. Spingate tries to climb up a boulder. She's not sure how to approach it. Bishop grabs her by the waist and lifts her like she weighs nothing at all. She squeals in delighted surprise as he sets her on top. She's so much prettier than I am, especially with the sun blazing off her red hair. She makes me so mad my skin prickles, a cascade of tiny needle pokes washing down my cheeks, my neck. I wonder how pretty she'd be if I punched her in the mouth, gave her a split lip to match the one I got fighting the monsters. Selfish Spingate deserves it. She already has Gaston, and now she wants Bishop too. My chest tightens, feels solid, like it's made of rock. I'll show that girl. I'll punish her. I shudder. Where did all of that come from? I feel the rage spreading through me, already dissipating but still strong, still vile and repulsive. Teresa Spingate is my friend. I would never hit her. My face flushes hot with embarrassment again, but this time I'm ashamed of my own jealousy. That tightness in my chest, it relaxes, releases. My temper. It's bad. I have to be careful. Is that how Matilda took over the grown-ups? Did her temper control her? Let her control them? Farrar climbs atop a big boulder, then drops down to the inner ring. He looks much better. The walk did him good. He helps Spingate down, his big hands on the bare skin of her narrow waist. Does everyone want to touch her? Stop it, Em. She's not doing anything wrong. Spingate kneels, gets to work examining the water. Coyote stands up again, the urge to jump in radiating off him.
Don't, Bishop says sharply.
Coyote sighs.
Okay, Dad.
He sits down. He looks at me.
Okay, Mom.
He clearly hates being told what to do. Aramovsky's influence or Coyote's normal personality. Spingate stands, pats her chest, as if to still a racing heart.
No mold, she says with audible relief. There's some rotten plant material mixed in, though. We could drink from this pool in a pinch, but I wouldn't recommend it.
She points up at the waterfall.
Probably cleaner up top. If we can collect it from there, we won't ever have to worry about water.
I breathe out, releasing a tension I hadn't realized I was carrying. This city is so large. There must be a system of pipes to bring water to all the buildings. If that system still works, and we find clean water closer to the shuttle, fine. If not, at least we have this waterfall. I may have to move everyone here. We could live in the building surrounding this plaza. At any rate, we will have to move somewhere. We can't stay in the shuttle forever. We're already packed in there like little chickens in a coop. If we open the coffins on deck 4, it could be much worse. Eventually, people will need their own space. Coyote stands atop his boulder, sets his thigh bone down.
Spingate did her testing. Can I do mine?
I look at her, silently asking if it is safe. She nods.
Swim away, I say. But I bet you can't do a perfect dive.
Coyote leaps far. His thin body slices into the pool with barely a splash. He stays under for a few seconds. When he pops up, wet dust is running off his skin.
The water is great!
He rubs hard as his face and hair ducks under, pops up again. Clean, he looks like a different person. On the Zolotl, he was an ash-covered gray warrior, fighting to keep us alive, fighting to set us free. On Omeokan, he's a young man barely out of his teens, flawless, perfect, innocent. I see Ferrara help Spingate step into the water. She laughs in surprised, open-mouthed shock.
Coyote, you liar! This is freezing!
She slips on the wet rocks, shrieks, grabs Ferrara's round shoulders as she goes down. They splash into the water together. Spingate stands. Her shirt was far too small to begin with. Now it hugs her like a transparent second skin. Either she doesn't know, or it doesn't bother her. Bishop steps closer to me.
Em, can we go in too?
Dried blood, ash smears, and dirt cover him head to toe. More of the same crusts in his blonde curls. Coyote looked beautiful when the water washed away his filth. Bishop will look even more so. And he's not the only one who could use a bath. I'm still coated in dead person dust, still caked with grime.
Sure, let's go.
He reaches halfway toward me, pauses, as if he wanted to take my hand, then didn't know if that was wrong. I could take his, but I don't. The awkward moment hangs there, neither of us knowing what to do. Then he turns and sprints toward the boulders. One powerful leg launches him to the top, where the other powerful leg sends him sailing out over the water. He arcs through the air, a dirt-covered mixture of grace and muscle. It looks like he will knife into the water just as Coyote did. But at the last second, Bishop tucks into a tight ball. When he hits, he sends us a big wave that splashes Spingate. She goes rigid and squeals with laughter. I use my spear like a cane, balancing myself as I climb over a tall boulder to stand on the wet rocks lining the pool. I look into the water. It gets deep fast, but the shallows hide jagged rocks. Are my friends all crazy jumping in like that? Bishop bursts from the surface. Water cascades down his now clean skin, sparkling in the sunlight. I flash back to the Zolotl, to the talk with Brewer, when I was staring at the gnarled creature and thinking, I don't know what a god is exactly, but if gods do exist, they don't look like this thing. No, if gods exist, they look like Bishop. I squat down on my heels, cup my hand and fill it with cold water. I rub it on my face. It feels amazing. I am so unclean. Should I take off my shirt? Be bare-chested like Bishop and Coyote and Ferrar? The thought of that embarrasses me even more than seeing Spingate in her see-through shirt. I'll keep my clothes on. I don't want these boys to see my body. At least not all the boys. I try not to stare at Bishop as I stand and look for a safe place to dive in. My foot suddenly slides off the wet rock and plunges into the water. I cry out in surprise, off balance. I drop my spear and whirl my arms, trying to stay up, but my other foot slips as well and I start to fall. Bishop catches me before I go all the way under. His arm is under my back, his hand on my hip. His body feels solid, so strong. His arms have the power to crush the life out of anyone, yet he holds me so gently. He's so close. His skin is so warm. Bishop opens his mouth to speak, then stops, as if words have escaped him. He lifts me, sets me back on the rock. He's still standing in the water. For once, I am taller than he is. Water drips from my ripped skirt. The bottom of my shirt is wet. It clings to my ribs, drips down my exposed belly. Coyotl and Farrar are laughing, splashing, oblivious to anything other than whatever new game they've concocted. Spingate, however, is looking right at me. My eyes meet hers. She smiles slightly, one corner of her mouth ticking open. She turns to Coyotl and Farrar.
I want to test the water at the top of the waterfall, she says to them. I'm not sure I can make it up there on my own. Can you two help?
Farrar's wide chest puffs out.
Yes, we'll help you.
Coyotl makes a strange face, then glances at Bishop, who still holds me in his arms. Coyotl's lip curls into a small smile, just like Spingate's.
Sure, he says to her. Happy to be of assistance.
The stone steps leading up are wide and dry. Spingate doesn't need any help. She's taking the others away so I can be alone with Bishop. He's still staring at me. He doesn't seem to notice anything but me. Farrar helps Spingate stand on a boulder. He starts up after her, but she pushes him, arms flailing. He splashes back into the pool. Water dripping from her scraps of clothing, Spingate hops off the boulder and runs for the steps.
Last one to the top is an ugly grown-up!
Coyotl and Farrar chase after her, laughing, enjoying the new game. They catch her almost immediately, but don't run past. They're more interested in walking by her side than winning. Up and up they go, talking as they climb. I can't hear them over the waterfall's roar. Bishop looks down at my foot.
Does it hurt?
It doesn't hurt at all.
Yes, I say. He kneels in the water. His big hands gently grip my ankle. His touch, it makes something surge in my stomach and chest, just like my rage at Spingate was instant and overwhelming. So too is this new sensation of heat, of thoughts lost in a swimming, dizzy whirl. He leans in, looking closely.
I don't think it's broken, he says. I should check your shin and calf.
His hand slides softly up my leg. Fingertips press in. Is he really seeing if I'm hurt? Or is he pretending just as much as I am?
He glances up at me with those beautiful dark yellow eyes. A warrior who will snarl and fight and kill. Yet he has such pretty eyes. The waterfall's roar fills my ears. My heart. Each beat feels like it's punching my chest. Bishop's lips, so pink. He rises slowly, sliding his hands to my hips. Then my ribs. I feel weak, boneless. This is the boy who saved my life. My mouth opens a little. I lean forward and down. My eyes shut. His lips on mine. Soft, warm. My world is the sound of crashing water and the feel of his mouth, the taste of his breath. His hands on my face, sliding to the back of my head, fingers in my hair. My hands shoot out, cup his cheeks, pull him closer. I feel the tip of his tongue touch mine. Something hits the pool. Boom, boom, an explosion of water. Bishop pulls away, looks toward the heavy splash we just heard, putting his body between me and the unknown danger. Farrar breaks the surface, gasping for air. A second later, Spingate does the same. I hear a yell from above, look up in time to see Coyotl leap off the waterfall. His legs kick and his arms flail as he plummets down. He plunges down between Farrar and Spingate, who are already swimming toward us.
They jumped?
Bishop launches himself into the pool, heads for Spingate. She swims like a fish, already leaving Farrar behind. She doesn't need help, but Bishop goes to her anyway. Coyotl pops up, gasping, swims toward me as hard as he can. He's terrified. I look up at the waterfall, and I see why. The late afternoon sun silhouettes something. A shape blurred by the nearly blinding light. Long, jointed legs. a segment pointing up connected to one pointing down. Matilda's memories rush forward, flash an almost matching image of that rough, horrifying form. They aren't that big. They can't be that big. But there it is, larger than Bishop and Farrar and Coyotl combined. A spider.
7. My hand thrusts into the water. My fingers find my spear. I point the metal tip at my new enemy. Spingate is the first out of the pool. She scrambles over the boulders, out of my line of sight. I can't see her, but I hear her shouting,
"Run! That thing is chasing us!"
My feet won't move. Bishop, Farrar, and Coyote rush out of the water. They snatch up their weapons. I stare up at the spider, a spindly shape, blurred by the shimmering sun. Perfectly still one second. The next, it's scurrying along the top of the waterfall, each step kicking up a high splash of water. We'll never outrun that. It stops at the stone steps. Long legs reach down, tap at the first switchback step. Reach, tap, pull back, reach, tap. The spider turns away and is instantly gone from sight. It wouldn't use the steps. Why? Are they too steep for it? Hands on my waist, Bishop flings me over his shoulder. In an instant, he bounds onto the big rocks, then down to the vine-covered street.
Bishop, let me go!
He does, fast and firm. He's terrified. As big as he is, that thing, that nightmare, is much bigger. I see the backs of Farrar, Coyotl, and Spingate. They're running the way we came, headed for the shuttle, or maybe the warehouse. But the warehouse is an hour away, the shuttle even farther. If that thing finds another path down from the cliff, we won't make it. It's far too fast. There is only one place we can go. I raise the spear high and scream with the same voice that rallied us in the garden when we fought the grown-ups.
To me! To me!
They all stop. Spingate and Farrar come running back, instantly trusting me. Coyote pauses, turns to run away, stops, snarls, then follows Spingate and Farrar. Bishop grips my shoulder. His touch was tender before. Now he forgets his own strength and it hurts.
Em, what are you doing? Didn't you see that thing? We have to run!
I whip my arm up, knocking his hand away. The others reach us. They are on the edge of panic. That shape, the way it moved, it frightens us at a level we can't deny. I look each of them in the eye as I speak.
We're going to that gate.
Coyotl shakes his head.
We should have run, he says.
He gestures wildly with his thigh bone, left, right, all over.
Now we have to hide in one of these buildings.
It took Spingate forever to get into the warehouse, I say. We can't be caught in the open if that thing comes. The gate is close. If the spider can't handle stone steps, it can't climb the city wall. We shut that gate behind us, we'll be safe. Farrar clutches his shovel to his chest.
The door could be stuck, he says.
Will it close? I have no idea if it will move at all, but I'm not going to waste a moment second guessing myself.
It's our best chance, I say. Move!
We run south down the vine-choked street, heading for the larger road that runs east-west. Spingate trips, regains her balance, runs hard at my side. She's so slow. Bishop stays beside me. I'm sprinting all out, yet he looks like he's barely jogging. Farrar and Coyotl could easily run out ahead of us, but they stay a few steps behind, protecting our backs. We reach the intersection. We turn left, away from the shuttle and the warehouse, and see the gate far off down the road. Tall doors set into a taller archway. Bishop sprints toward it, red axe gleaming. We chase after him, running as hard as we can. My lungs burn, my stomach clutches. Spingate stumbles. She's already drained. I hold the spear in one hand, slide my free arm under her shoulder to support her. I have to keep her moving. She gets a burst of energy when we hear Farrar call out from behind us.
It's coming!
I don't look back. The door. It is survival. It is life itself. I run, part of me waiting for the spider thing to bring me down from behind, for the pointy legs to punch through my back and out my chest. The gate looms closer. Bishop is already there. He stands half behind the right-hand door, which is slightly open to whatever lies beyond. The wall stretches off to either side, high, impenetrable. He waves us in, desperate for us to move faster. Spingate and I reach the doors, sheets of metal, as thick as my forearm is long. We rush through the opening. Coyotl and Farrar are right behind us. They drop their weapons, throw themselves against the door alongside Bishop. I stand there, trying to breathe, as the three boys attack a metal slab that is four times as tall as they are. Their arms shake, their legs tremble, their feet push against vines that slip and slide away. Over the boys' grunts, I hear a faint grinding sound. The door is closing, but too slowly. As it moves, long vines bunch underneath it, thick stalks jamming between the bottom of the door and the street's flat stone. I rush back through. I use my spear blade to slice at the vines. Spingate joins me, chopping away with Farrar's sharp shovel. Blue juice splatters and sprays. The smell of mint is everywhere. We cut, we kick, clearing space. A new sound, a horrid whine. Far down the street, I see it coming. My skin shivers and prickles. Dark yellow, with thin strips of green and brown. Three jointed legs moving so fast they are blurs. Little flecks of torn vine tossed high in their wake. The hungry whine echoes through the streets, bounces off the ziggurat walls. The spider runs with a wobble, a halting hitch. One of the legs is lame, maybe. If it reaches us, it will tear us to shreds. I grab Spingate, shove her through the slowly closing door, then squeeze through the narrowing gap myself. On the other side, I stand next to Coyotl, hurl all my strength at the door. Spingate does the same. The massive hinges screech and howl, seem to fight our desperate effort. But my toes find purchase in the plant juice slick stones, and I feel the slab of metal moving. The door's grinding grows louder, but so does the spider's whine. Bishop's extended arms tremble with effort. Sweat pours off his skin. His voice is a roar of command.
Everything you've got! God damn it! Push!
Coyotl and Farrar groan with effort. Spingate screams, a combination of fear and frustration and rage. The door picks up speed. I hear the spider's hard feet clicking against the stone street, lying beneath the vines, a harsh, rapid drumbeat of oncoming death. The hinges give a final tortured shriek. The door clangs shut with a reverberating gong that hangs in the air. Everyone sags, even Bishop. If the spider can get through these doors, we don't have the strength to run, let alone fight. The whining sound stops. I keep my hands pressed against the door. I hear and feel a scraping coming from the other side. Hard-shelled legs scratching at thick metal, searching for a way through, a way to get at us. The scraping stops. That whine again. Faint. Then fading. Then nothing. Is the spider gone? Or is it standing there, motionless, waiting for us? We'll rest here for a minute, I say, as if we could do anything else. Farrar falls to the ground. Coyotl slumps to his butt, his back against the door. Bishop's hands are on his knees, his stomach heaving in and out as he tries to get his breathing under control. Spingate seems the least winded. Her hands are on her hips, her lips are pursed.
Spin, what happened back there?
She laces her fingers over her head.
At the top.
Jungle on either side of the river, she says, forcing words through deep breaths.
Trees. Real trees, not the vines.
Coyotl went in.
For a closer look. I was testing the water. He came sprinting out, shouting at us to jump. I saw what was behind him. It almost got us. But it wasn't a spider.
What are you talking about?
We all saw it.
She closes her eyes, shudders.
5 legs, not 8.
Her correction angers me. Like the number of legs matter? Bishop stands straight. He gleams with sweat.
So it attacked?
Coyote sees that Bishop is standing, struggles to his feet.
It came after us. Maybe I should have fought it. I wasn't afraid, but there was Spingate and... well, I wasn't afraid.
Still lying on his back, Farrar raises a hand.
I was. Glad we jumped into the pool. Because when I saw that thing, I think I peed in my pants a little.
Coyote glares at him. Bishop nods.
It scared me too.
His admission of fear seems to relax Coyote. If even Bishop is afraid, then running away from the spider couldn't be such a bad thing. I put my shoulder to the door again, give it a little push to make sure it's really closed. It is. At my feet, I see mashed vines, blue smeared curving lines on the stone where the door scraped against it. No way I can relax, not even a bit. But with the door shut, I have a moment to think. I turn and rest my back against the door. In front of me, trees, more than I could ever count. Before us lies a dense jungle, growing up and through and around blackened, burned, crumbling, vine-choked, six-sided buildings. Trees also grow out of giant, plant-covered holes in the ground. There are long, open spaces that were maybe once roads, but it's hard to tell with all the holes and trees and the endless yellow vines that cover everything. When we first landed, I thought the sprawling city was a ruin, taken by the hands of time. What I see now shows me I was wrong. The city we landed in isn't ruined. It is merely abandoned and overgrown. Most of those four-sided buildings are still standing. What I look at now is something else altogether. These six-sided buildings weren't abandoned. They were destroyed. Part 2. Walls and Wonders. 8. We walk through the jungle. The curving wall is on our right, tall and constant, covered with layers of thick vines. Following it takes us mostly south and a little east. We hope to run across another gate soon, but we have no way of knowing if we will, or if it will be open. I'm very worried. We've eaten what little food we brought with us, and we're already out of water. Keeping the wall on our right means the thick jungle is on our left. Tall trees with dark yellow leaves, green or brown trunks. Plenty of vines there, too, dangling from branches and covering the collapsed buildings. Blurreds, some as big as I am, dart in and out of the trees, or fly full speed into the deep canopy where they vanish from sight. The heat is worse here than it is in the city. It's so humid. It seems that every other step squishes into mud, which hides jagged old sticks and a brown plant that has sharp thorns. Each time we step on one, we have to stop so someone can carefully pull thorns from the soles of our feet. That slows us down, makes me hate the grown-ups anew. They dressed us up like dolls, so couldn't they have given us shoes? The sun is descending on the far side of the city. The wall casts a growing shadow upon us. I don't want to be outside when night falls, but it looks like we can't avoid that. Animal noises reach out to us from deep in the jungle. The cries and howls of creatures that might be waking up from a day's sleep to hunt when darkness fully sets in. So many questions. These six-sided buildings, scored and gutted, covered by the undying jungle. How far do they reach? Does this massive wall go all the way around our ziggurat city? Spingate gestures to the sprawling ruins on our left. Maybe a big fire burned them all, she says. Or it could have been a meteor shower. Rocks hitting so hard they made craters, caused explosions that started fires. Bishop laughs at this. Spingate, are you joking? Not at all, she says, bristling that he would doubt her.
Rocks can come from space at high speeds, partially burning up as they hit the atmosphere, and... He holds up a fist, which means we're supposed to stop. We do. He faces her.
You really don't know what caused all of this.
She seems defensive.
No? Do you?
Bishop nods.
War.
One word. So simple. And from looking at the devastation around us, so horrible. We start walking again. It seems so obvious now. How could I have thought so much damage came from anything but war? Destruction. Killing. Just like on the Zolotl. But at a scale that is hard to conceive. How many people died? Thousands? Millions? On one side of this wall lie endless ruins and carnage. On the other, untouched buildings damaged only by plants, only by time and neglect. It doesn't take a genius like Spingate or Gaston to figure out what happened. My kind destroyed a city so they could build their own in the same place. Even down here, we can't escape the grown-up's violent touch. Bishop raises a fist. We stop. He crouches down, stares off into the darkening ruins.
Em, come here, he whispers.
I squat beside him. He points to a ruined building. Three of its six vine-choked walls have collapsed. There is no roof to stop the young trees growing tall from within. Bishop leans close to me.
Do you see it?
I look, but see nothing that should cause concern.
It's a ruined building. We've passed hundreds of them.
His eyes narrow, like he's disappointed. My heart plummets. I can't stand the idea that he thinks poorly of me.
Not the building itself, he says. Look just above it.
Now I see it. Against the barely lit sky, a thin column of smoke rises up from somewhere beyond that building.
A campfire, he says. Someone is out there.
People. People who are not us. We're not alone after all. Bishop looks at me. Once again, we're close enough to kiss. But this isn't the time for that.
I'll go look, he says. See what's there.
No, it's too dangerous. What if it's another spider? He considers this carefully, then shakes his head.
A spider didn't try to open the door. It easily outweighs all of us combined. All it had to do was push, but it didn't even try. If it's not smart enough to open a door, it's not smart enough to build a fire.
He's right. It's an animal. An animal that attacked us.
The spider's inside the city walls, where the rest of our people are, I say. We need to get back to the shuttle as fast as possible. And besides, it's almost dark. There could be more spiders in the jungle.
Bishop considers this, bites at his lower lip. He used to just act. Now, he thinks first. It's definitely an improvement.
The fire means someone lives out there, he says. Doesn't that mean they must have food that isn't poisoned by the mold?
From behind me, Spingate lets out a cough of surprise.
He's right, she says. I mean, they could be immune to the toxin somehow, but however they beat it, we need to know.
Bishop has a good point, and looking for food was the whole purpose of this trip.
All right, I say. We'll check it out.
He smiles, starts to rise.
I said we, Bishop.
You're not going alone. He wasn't expecting that.
Then I'll take Farrar.
I touch the back of his hand.
No. All of us. Together. We shouldn't have split up before.
He pauses, then pulls his hand away. His eyes cast down. Together, he and I made the choice to abandon Bello. And did we learn from our mistake?
No.
At the waterfall, we let Spingate, Farrar, and Coyote go off by themselves so we could be alone together. The spider could have hurt them, and that's our fault.
Bishop turns his head, speaks just loud enough for everyone to hear him. Farrar, stay on my right. Coyote on my left. M and Spingate, stay close behind, but far enough back so you can run if something attacks.
We are new to this planet,
to this city, but it seems we have neighbors. In a moment, we will find out if they are friend or foe. Bishop silently leads us into the jungle ruins. 9. We find the fire. Whoever made it is gone. Glowing coals cast tendrils of smoke into the darkening night. Someone built a fire pit in the middle of this six-sided ruin. With no roof and one wall collapsed, the fire builders had protection from 5 sides. Maybe they cooked bread. I faintly smell burned toast. The sun finally slides behind the city wall. The sky burns a molten sunset red. Jungle shadows thicken.